Good evening, everyone. Thank you all so very much for coming along tonight. My name is Lewis, and as you've just heard, I'm a research fellow based at the University of Leicester in England in the Space Research Centre. So I've come from a biological background, and actually I'm something of a freak, something of an anomaly in the Space Research Centre at the university there. And the field of science that I'm involved in, my fellowship is all about, is in a relatively new field of science called astrobiology, which is all about trying to understand the origins of life on Earth and the ranges of conditions that terrestrial organisms can survive under and tolerate, and then extending that knowledge to see where else life might be able to survive, where else the solar system may have the right conditions for organisms, for life. And I spend most of my time thinking about Mars, our next door neighbor planet, how you can detect biosignatures or signs of life in a dusty Martian soil. But something I've been thinking a lot about in the last few years is on something completely and utterly different. Let's imagine that this happens. There's some kind of global catastrophe, a doomsday, and the vast majority of humanity dies and our civilization collapses. There's an apocalypse event. But some people survive. Let's say that for whatever reason, this seminar room, this workshop we're in right now, serves as some kind of hardened bunker, and we survive. The rest of humanity has perished, but we form some kind of post-apocalyptic community. We stumble outside about an hour's time into the ruins of the civilization that's now fallen. Well, what now? What do you need to know? Not just to survive in the immediate aftermath, but to thrive in the long term. How could you go about building a new society for yourself? How could you start reconstructing or rebooting civilization from scratch? What would be the most important scientific knowledge you'd want to try and preserve, and technologies that would be most useful and have been most useful throughout our own history? And perhaps most interestingly, could you accelerate rebooting civilization? Could you navigate some kind of shortcut route, some kind of optimized route to that vast network of scientific discoveries and technologies and interlinked capabilities? We meandered around and flowed down lots of dead ends and red herrings in our history. Could you go straight from A to B with the right knowledge, with hindsight, and knowing what turns out to be the most important technologies and knowledge? So, in a nutshell, if we were a post-apocalyptic community of survivors, what single book would we want handed to us that tells us all of the most important information, a kind of manual, a quick start guide to civilization, if you like? And it should come as no surprise that this is the book I've tried to write. This is the knowledge, how to rebuild a world from scratch. And I think I should make it clear, if it isn't already, I don't actually think doomsday is upon us. I don't have some kind of the end of the world is nigh placard around my chest. But I think this notion of the apocalypse and the loss, everything that we take for granted today, is the great starting point for thought experiments, the ultimate what-if question. What are the fundamentals? What are the pillars that support our everyday lives, the stuff we take for granted? And how do civilizations progress and develop over history? What are the great enablers or transitions that civilizations go through? And I think a very nice example of the problem, the challenges that we would face if we did have to start everything from the ground up, everything from scratch, is discussed, explained very nicely in an essay by Leonard Reed called iPencil. And this is a pencil. Now, the iPencil isn't some hugely underwhelming new gadget from Apple. The iPencil is a story, a narrative, told from the point of a pencil, the simplest tool or implement ever likely to use or interact with in our day-to-day lives. And the shocking realization is that there is not a single person on the planet that knows how to make a pencil. No one person. Because human knowledge is distributed
across the entire population, from knowing how to operate a timber mill or to dig ore out of the ground and smelt it, make metal, or to refine tools that we use for moving and transporting things around. No one person knows all the details of all of those steps, and this is just the simplest thing we're likely to use. So what steps would you need to go through to build a society and learn everything else you don't already have or don't already know? And the main themes of knowledge, of understanding that I've picked out, is this list here. This is basically a list of chapters from the book. And during the course of this talk, for about 45 minutes or so, I'll skip through some things like agriculture, and then the basics, which none of us living in cities anymore really have any idea about, how to take a handful of seed and walk out into a muddy field and make food come back out of that field before the winter draws in, or you starve to death. Or thinking about the crucial materials and substances that our everyday lives depend upon. Do you know how to get metal out of rock, out of the ore? What are the basics of making these fundamentally important substances like wood and metal and glass? And moving through other areas such as power and transport, communication. And actually the chapter I found most satisfying to research and write in this project is the penultimate one, time and place. And you can treat this as another kind of self-contained thought experiment. Imagine, for whatever reason, imagine you wake up, perhaps you've woken from a long coma, or you've just found the cryogenic pod that you were being stored in has just popped open, or you've stumbled through a time warp, or whatever. You find yourself somewhere on the earth and at some point in the future. You have no idea where you are or when you are. So what observations can you make? How can you deduce from first principles your location on the planet, your latitude and longitude, and what time is? And I don't just mean, is it lunchtime? Is it 2 o'clock in the afternoon? This is quite an easy thing to determine with a sundial that you can plant a stick in the ground. But how do you work out what date it is? Can you work out what day of the year it is? I.e., could you reconstruct the calendar? Or could you even work out what year it is, maybe 10,000 years in the future? Which is, you know, always the first question to stumble out the lips of any time traveler in a film is, what year is this man? Well, how would you work that out for yourself? How could you use first principles to deduce that from scratch for yourself? And again, these aren't frivolous questions. Being able to work out where on the earth you are is a fundamental prerequisite for navigation and exploration and trade across the oceans. And being able to track your progress through the year, through the seasons, and reconstructing a calendar is fundamental to successful agriculture, making sure you put your seeds in the ground at the right time and harvest them again before the winter draws in and you starve to death. These are some of the most important challenges and problems that civilization has been solving for centuries and millennia. So what cheat sheet would you be given that tells you how to do all of that for yourself from the ground up? Well, if we stay within the kind of premise of this thought experiment, of a post-apocalyptic world where most of the people suddenly died, and I talk in the book about the best way for the world to end, as it were. Most of the people have suddenly died, but the stuff is left lying around. As a community of survivors, you'd be afforded a kind of grace period. You'd be able to scavenge and forage for what you need for the time being. You would not have to wake up the morning after, the night before, when the world as we know it ended, and have to start growing your own food immediately. You could scavenge for what you need. And today, we are exceedingly good at preserving and stockpiling food. We create little pockets of artificial winter. We exploit gas floors to build refrigerators and freeze them. And particularly with the canning process, we can save food for decades without going off. So again, this is a thought experiment. I wanted to know, if I got locked at a supermarket, for whatever reason, if I were to lock you in a supermarket, how long could you survive before you'd either eaten all of the food, gone off before you could get around to it? And I went to the supermarket, which conveniently turned out to be on the road I live off on. I walked up and down the aisles of this supermarket, counting everything up, multiplying up all the food that was there, and dividing it by the amount you would need to eat per day to survive. And it turns out the single supermarket support you in Fiji 55 years. Or 63 years, you can dog food, cat food as well. So a slightly flippant example there. You wouldn't be in any particular hurry. You would have this great period to work out farming for yourself through trial and error before it became a matter of life and death. And of course, water is another fundamental necessity or requirement for life. And the question here is, what modern knowledge, what modern understanding could you apply to know for sure that the water you're about to put your lips and drink is not going to kill you? That it doesn't contain waterborne diseases like typhoid or cholera that have been the scourge of humanity throughout history? How can you know that your water is safe to drink? Well, if you're scavenging in the deserted cities and abandoned supermarkets, you get something like kitchen bleach. And if you dilute it down enough, do not drink concentrated kitchen bleach unless you're looking for a quick exit from this post-apocalyptic wasteland. But if you dilute enough kitchen bleach, it will chemically disinfect water for you using exactly the same chemistry as water that comes out of the faucets is disinfected. You're using the chemistry of chlorine to kill the bacteria and germs for you. And if you can't find any kitchen bleach, you could use something like swimming pool chlorine to exactly the same effect. So sodium hypochlorite or calcium hypochlorite. These are sources of chlorine. But actually, there's an even simpler way of knowing that the water you're going to drink is safe. And this process is called SODIS, or solar disinfection. And it's been touted around the developing world by the World Health Organization. And all you need is an empty plastic bottle. And you can fill up your plastic bottle with your suspect water and leave it in the bright sunshine. Because that bottle is essentially constraining the water to be very shallow, the ultraviolet rays in the sunshine can shine straight through and then activate and kill any pathogens or bacteria that are in there. So you can come back a day or two's time and know that water is safe to drink by applying modern knowledge. Now, fire as well, of course, has been absolutely crucial throughout history. We use fire to cook our food and to kill germs and meat and to keep us warm, to keep the cold at bay. But civilization uses fire in a very fundamental way as well. We use fire to take the base substances that we can dig out of the ground and we transform them into the most useful materials and substances of history. We take river mud, clay, and we bake it into bricks for building. We use fire to get metal out of rock, out of the ore. And we use fire to drive much of the crucial chemistry that underpins our society today, like making artificial fertilizers that feed over 2 billion mouths on the planet today. So our modern world is as reliant on fire as a Stone Age family huddled over the campfire. We've just hidden it behind the scenes in our factories and our power stations. So the question, again, is if you can't find any matches or lighters, how can you start a fire? How can you make a fire and then start using it? And I would wager, maybe not much, because I got called on this last night, but I would wager there's not many people in this room who actually know how to start a fire for themselves by rubbing sticks together or getting something ignited. So the video I've got for you here shows a neat little trick, how you can use weird and wonderful combinations of everyday items that you can scavenge or forage from abandoned supermarkets to start a fire for you. And in this short clip, I show you how you can start a fire using a fire detector, using a smoke alarm, which you would normally associate with warning you of a fire. But perhaps most surprisingly, it can even use a fire alarm to start a fire with. And if we turn over the back of the fire alarm, take out the battery that it's got in there. And this is a standard 9-volt battery with the two terminals, both at the same end. And we scavenge something like wire wool from any kitchen or supermarket. And if you take the terminals of the battery and just brush them against the steel wool, it'll short circuit and heat up those very, very fine wires because they're very narrow and there's lots of resistance. So if we try that, you can really get roaring fire started. But what I think is absolutely amazing about that, that metal just bursting into flames. This isn't dry newspaper or some kindling. That's the metal itself burning. And what you're doing there, of course, is exploiting the scientific principle of electrical resistance. You're taking a current, an actual current, forcing it through a very narrow wire with therefore high resistance, so it gets hot and bursts in flames. And if you can pull off another trick, which is pushing wire through pushing electricity through a thin wire and not have it burst into flames, you've just cracked how to make a light bulb. That's exactly what Edison solved in the invention of the light bulb. So electricity too is another support on the foundation of our modern world. And one of the things I was very, very keen to try and do when I was researching and getting knowledge is keep rooting everything I was talking about in real examples. Not just speculative arm waving, but to root it in real examples from our own history. And what we're looking at here is a city called Gorazda, which in the mid-1990s and the Bosnian-Serbian War, this city became surrounded by the army, cut off from the rest of the world. And although they received food and medication from NATO, they were cut off from the electricity grid, thrown back in the Middle Ages in that sense. And what the inhabitants of Gorazda were able to do, scavenge and forage rubbish, junk, just lying around in their cities, and they constructed for themselves these water wheels. You can see they've dipped into fast-flowing stream in the middle of the river and tethered to bridge it. They've done junkyard wars for real and made these water wheels for themselves. And the crucial component, right in the core of each of these makeshift water wheels, the thing that converts that motion into electricity is an alternator, something you can scavenge from the hood of any abandoned car or truck and keep your lifestyle electrified, to make a local off network for yourself if the grid ever goes down. And I think this is an incredible example of the resourcefulness and ingenuity of just normal, everyday people solving challenges under difficult situations, like this war zone they found themselves in here. But sooner or later, this grace period, this period where you're able to scavenge and forage for what you need, will draw to an end. Things are decaying and deteriorating, or you're just using them up, and they're not being made anymore by civilization. So sooner or later, you're going to have to work out how to make and do things for yourself before it runs out. And particularly within agriculture, the most important plants in history have been these, the cereal crops, in particular the first three, wheat, rice, and maize, which have supported all of the civilizations of Europe, Asia, and the Americas. And this dominance of cereals in our diets means that throughout the history of civilization, humanity has thrived by eating grass. The cereal crops evolved fast-growing species of grass. They're the ideal plants to extract nutrition to feed yourself. But we had a problem. The kernel of wheat is a fabulous nugget of nutrition, but it's hard and indigestible. So what we need to do is break down that grain to unlock those nutrients so that our body's able to absorb it. And the most important inventions that have enabled us to do that through history have been the Roman water wheel and the medieval windmill. These are clearly ways of harnessing natural power sources, hydropower, wind power, to save the effort of own muscles. But the crucial part of both of these are these pair of cylindrical slabs, the millstones, which turn over each other and grind that grain into flour. This is a relic of Stone Age technology, right in the heart of the complex mechanisms of the medieval windmill. And we take that flour and we cook it. We bake bread. And the heat of the cooking fire makes the food taste nice, but more fundamentally, it helps to break that food down to release nutrients so that our body is able to absorb it. So in a very real sense, the millstones are like a technological extension of our own molar teeth. And the oven for baking bread or the pot for boiling rice are like an external pre-digestive system. Humanity is biologically disadvantaged. We don't have the four stomachs of a cow to eat grass. So we've had to adopt technologies to enable us to live off fast-growing species of grass. And again, if Eric hadn't mentioned this right at the beginning, but I guess there would really know where you can go to get seed corn or rice that you can put in the ground that will then grow reliably year after year. And this is where you would go to get the crops that you would need to plant to reboot agriculture yourself. This is the global seed vault, as we heard, way up in the Arctic, on the island of Svalbard. And the first thing you'd hope for after getting all the way to Svalbard and meeting these pair of glass-proof doors is that someone's left the key under the rug at the front so you can let yourself in. And as we heard, even if the grid goes down, it wasn't designed to serve as a vault of the crops for rebooting agriculture after the apocalypse, but it would serve very well at this. And it's basically a library of crop species, a genetic save file. And you could come here, and even if the grid goes down, the permafrost, the mountain this facility is built inside of, will keep it naturally refrigerated for centuries or a thousand or more years. You would come here, gather the need to start regrowing and supporting your civilization. Now, if you don't happen to know where Svalbard is, or how to get there, I very helpfully provided for you the latitude and longitude of where you need to go to. And if you don't know, I'm going to move that microphone over. That's it. If you don't happen to know what your latitude and longitude coordinates are here, what is your address on the planet? And therefore, what direction do you start heading into to get there? Turn to that time and place chapter book, and it tells you from first principles how to work that out for yourself. As far as possible, everything within the knowledge links into everything else. I don't presuppose any prior knowledge or external knowledge. It all links into each other, as far as that's possible. I'm going to skip through substances, something we can come back to in question and discussion if you fancy. But within transport and moving things around, what you ideally would really like to be able to prevent is your post-apocalyptic society, your community, from regressing to states like this. We've lost engines, you've lost mechanization, and you have to resort to your own muscles or hitching up draft horse or oxen to move things around and do things for you. And it's not just hopping in your car driving down the road. Mechanization performs a whole number of different functions for us today, and I'm leaving the background labor we would have to have done otherwise. So the question is, how can you keep machinery going without active crude oil or the diesel and gasoline, the refined fruit? Well, to demonstrate this, I've brought along a gasifier stove, it's called. I have here, and I made this myself out of just some old junk tin cans. There's a larger outer can here and a smaller can inside it. And there's a row of air holes at the bottom of both these cans. So if you put a little bit of newspaper inside, just a small handful of twigs, and set fire to it, the air holes draw the air and the oxygen up through that fuel, so it ignites and combusts nice and intensely, just like any barbecue would do. But what is unique about this gasifier stove is that there's a second row of holes at the top. So as that wood breaks down in the heat of the fire and undergoes pyrolysis and gives off lots of vapors and gases and smoke, which is itself combustible, you then reintroduce oxygen and burn all of those hot gases as well. When this is running, it's smokeless and very, very efficient. And demonstrating that on the TED stage last week in Vancouver almost set my head on fire. It started spitting out quite a few kind of sparks and ashes at first getting started, and I realized I'd put an enormous amount of hairspray into my hair as I was leaning over this thing. So I don't think I'm going to like this indoors anymore. And so instead, I've got a video of this gasifier stove under operation. So let's get this fired up, see it working. I'll load it up with some simple Kindle. You may have noticed I misspoke there and said loading your Kindle into a gas fire. So don't put your newspaper. Try and burn it in one of those.
Some dried twigs.
It's much, much more effective.
Should we push down in here? If I light the underneath with a lighter, you've been
so
able to scavenge.
So cheating with a lighter, I hope I've convinced you. I could totally have used a smoke detector if I really wanted to light this gas fire stove. If you watch,
once smoke starts, we'll put
that smoke disappears and is replaced
slightly
high by
flue on it.
Jet of
and already, that's roaring away with the air and the oxygen being drawn up. So to get that going nice and intensely, burning down that fuel. And if I take off this flue now, this is also called a rocket stove, perhaps for obvious reasons. If I take off that flue, if you come in here and look, you can see that upper ring of air holes. There are jets of flame coming out there where the oxygen has been drawn in and igniting all those producer gases coming off from the wood, undergoes pyrolysis and gives off the vapor and the gas. And the smoke itself is combustible. So burning all of that is a very, very efficient way of using the fuel. So I reckon that's about ready for cooking. Put on my plate and the custard we opened earlier.
I thought I should explain the custard at that point. This is the third in a triptych of videos that we created for the hardback of the knowledge coming out last year. And the first of these three videos is where I've scavenged through an abandoned supermarket because I'm starving hungry and I found some cans of food to eat, but don't have a can opener. So how can you open a can without a can opener? Or indeed any other tool whatsoever? And there's a very, very neat trick you can use. Just pop off, really simply pop off the lid of a can. And the punchline, if you like, at the end of that first video was, it's custard, it's cold custard. Who wants to eat that? So the second video is how you can start a fire using weird and wonderful combinations of everyday objects. And we saw one example using a smoke detector. I also show you how you can start a fire using a bottle of water, which you paradoxically normally associate with putting one out. And the third video is how to make most efficient use of that timber, of the firewood and fire. And this kind of gasifier stove is exactly the kind of appropriate technology, as Eric mentioned, that is being touted around the developing world, because it's really easy to make and maintain yourself. And it makes the most efficient use of the firewood that a family can collect. And the fact that it's smokeless when it runs means it's much, much healthier for cooking in cramped, closed conditions. And what you can do is take this gasifier stove, and if you scale it up from something the size of a soup can, and scale it up to something the size of a trash can, strap it to the back of a car, you can run a car using wood fuel rather than diesel or gasoline. This is the gasifier on the back here, the wood breaking down in the heat of the fire to give off these producer gases, which you pipe on over the top of the car, down into the engine, where they're finally allowed to mix with oxygen and explosively drive this car forward. Now, admittedly, this does look like some kind of crazy steampunk post-apocalyptic Mad Max contraption, but it works. And this isn't some fringe hobby. During the shortages of the Second World War, there were over a million gasifier powered cars, wood powered cars across Europe. This is exactly the kind of intermediate technology you could use to stop the further aggression of your society and start pulling yourself back up by your own bootstraps. Within materials, I've already hinted, of course, how useful metals are for making tools and maybe weapons and things that you can use. And your first problem in getting access to metals is smelting them out of the ore. And the easiest metals to smelt, things like copper, which were the Bronze Age, in before the Iron Age. We now have the Age of Steel and aluminum, and all these other materials and metals that we use today. And again, something I was very, very keen to try and do when I was researching for the knowledge is not just base it on books that I've been reading and working in a library or talking to lots of people, by actually doing things myself firsthand, so I could then write from the experience. And so I spent a day in a 17th century traditional blacksmith's, making a tool by my own hands from scratch. And when you think about it, the craft of the blacksmith is really simple. You get a great big pile of fuel, either charcoal or coke, set it on fire, get it burning really hot by blasting air up through it with a set of bellows, take the bit of metal you want to work on, shove it in the hot place so it gets very hot and soft, and then hit the hell out of it with another bit of metal, which is still cold and therefore hard. Use iron to work on iron, to make tools for yourself. And this is me feeling very macho, spending a day hitting the life out of a piece of metal on a hammer and anvil to make a tool for myself, to make a knife that you can see down here. And you can come up and have a look at yourself at the front, if you like. Come and have a look at this knife. And I felt pretty smug with myself after a day working by hammer and anvil and making a tool from scratch with my own hands. And the very first thing I did after getting back home into our apartment, I marched straight into the kitchen and used my knife to cut some bread, and cut some cheese, and make myself a post-apocalyptic grilled cheese from scratch, and ate that. But I then realized, if you look, there's a ruinous crack that's appeared. We can come up and have a look at the artifact itself. A ruinous crack that's appeared between the handle and the blade of the knife. So I've actually done a pretty bad job of making my first tool for myself. But importantly, I know what went wrong, and I have to go back again and make a better shot, a better stab, if you excuse the pun, at making a knife. And so as a microcosm of how society in general progresses, this knife illustrates the point quite nicely. Progression is about being rational and applying logical thinking, analytical thinking, the things that we make, working out whether they're not working properly or how to make them work better, to bug hunt our technology and then improve it reiteratively each time we have another go, another effort. One of the very most important technologies you want to leapfrog to within communications technology is the printing press. And in our own history, before the printing press was invented, if you want to copy a document, if you want to share your ideas, the only way of doing that was to fill an entire room full of people and have them copy it out letter by letter in handwriting. It's enormously time consuming and laborious and expensive. And that means that only rich and powerful people get to choose which ideas are allowed to spread. But with the printing press, it's almost as if knowledge itself becomes democratic. Anyone can have any ideas they like and distribute them and share them across the whole population. So this is very much a technology you want to leapfrog to help many areas of society accelerate and progress all at the same time. And another thing I was very smug with myself, and I realized that I was able to pull this off, was in the pages of the knowledge, the pages of this book, I explain how to make your own paper from scratch. I explain how to make your own ink, and I explain how to construct a rudimentary printing press. So it's almost as if, within the pages of the knowledge, it contains the genetic instructions for its own reproduction. Tongue in cheek, of course, only one copy of this manual would need to survive the apocalypse and is able to reproduce itself, and you can hand that copy to your entire apocalyptic community of survivors, and everyone can benefit from that knowledge. And again, as a proof of principle, here is a page of the book, the page explaining how to make the printing press, printed with a rudimentary printing press onto handmade paper, just to demonstrate that proof of principle, to demonstrate how it can be done. It's gonna fall over. The very last topic I want to talk about, and we can pick up on any of these strands when we come to the Q&A and the discussion at the end, is within advanced chemistry. And in the early days, as you're rebuilding your society, and as we were doing a few centuries ago, you can harvest what you need from the natural world around you. You can make lime for yourself, or soda, or potash, all of these things you've probably not heard of, but are the underpinnings of all of the chemistry that supports our society. But sooner or later, as your civilization progresses and your population grows, you'll hit a limit. You'll hit a threshold. You won't be able to gather what you need quickly enough from the world around you. You have to learn how to make it yourself. And our civilization hit that threshold, that limit for soda in the early 1800s. That's the very beginnings of industrial chemistry. And we hit the limit for nitrate in the early 1900s. And to make nitrate, which you need for fertilizers and explosives and gunpowder, which the European powers were interested in at the time, to make your own nitrate, use the Haber process. Use this single chemical step that makes a foul-smelling chemical called ammonia, which you use to make artificial fertilizers that today feed a third of the world's population. This is what I discuss in this chapter about advanced chemistry. And I also talk about the very curious, light-sensitive chemistry of silver. And I swear the next slide I'm about to show you is the most narcissistic one I will show in this talk. Because I was keen that even the author mugshot on the back of the book remains true to the premise of the knowledge. I wanted to make a photo by myself from scratch. Not pay some digital photographer to take 10,000 photos of me gurning in different ways and pick out the one where I wasn't looking horrible. So this is the picture we took. This took all day to make, down at Laycock Abbey, where photography was invented in the 1830s and 1840s. And I worked with an historian there to genuinely mix very simple chemistry that you can make yourself, the silver-containing chemistry, doused that onto a single plate of glass, loaded that into a primitive single-lens camera, and had this portrait taken all day to get. You'll notice I'm looking a bit, well, grumpy, because this is a 16-second exposure. This isn't a snapshot. I would challenge any one of you to sit absolutely dead still, your head not moving or relaxing the slightest, and your facial muscles, if you're smiling, to not twitch at all, because the slightest movement over 16 seconds and your entire head blurs into this ghostly apparition. So you can only sit there with a very passive, neutral expression, this gurn here. And what you can't see is that behind me, there is a wrought iron stand and a skull clamp locked at the back of my head to hold my head absolutely still all those 16 seconds. And so I put it to you that the reason that all of these the earliest photographs we have of Edwardian gentlemen, Victorian ladies, the reason they look so joyless isn't because they didn't know how to have a good time back in the 1900s, or the 1850s and 1860s. It's an artifact of the technology that was available. The way that we could catch a moment in time back then using this simple silver chemistry took so long that it was impossible to capture a smile. We look at history through a distorted lens, in this case, almost literally, as how we perceive how the previous generations would have lived. Now, if any of this has been of any interest at all, there is a book, there's the knowledge which you can get. There's also a website where a whole lot of material that didn't make it into the final edit of the book, I put up as various articles, all the videos I've been showing short clips so you can watch in full. There's instructions about how to make your own gasifier stove from scratch, which is a great kind of project with your children before going on a camping holiday. There's lots of articles and lists of the best post-apocalyptic sci-fi books to read, or books like Robinson Crusoe or Swiss Van Robinson or The Martian, the idea of starting from absolute scratch and rebuilding capability and rebuilding civilized lifestyle for yourself. And there's this article as well about Miley Cyrus. And this is another thought experiment. Imagine that you had a time machine, you had a DeLorean, and you go 400 years back into the past, back into history, and you get to take one single scientific instrument, one experiment with you, to prove something profound and deep about our Earth, the world, or the cosmos we live in. To try and prove something that the people didn't believe or understand back then. What scientific instrument would you take? An instrument that I would take and bundle into the boot of my DeLorean before traveling back 400 years into the past would be Miley Cyrus. Or at least Miley and her wrecking ball. So I'd go back to the 1500s, find a nice tall cathedral, set Miley up on her wrecking ball, get her nice and comfortable, like she's looking in this picture here, and give her a good shove instead of swinging back and forth. And if you watch mine swinging back and forth on her wrecking ball over the course of the day, you'll notice something very curious, something very strange. That pendulum swinging back and forth seems to swivel over the ground during the course of the day. Now, there's no wind in this cathedral blowing Miley. There's no force acting to twist that pendulum round. So the only conclusion that you can come to is that it's the entire planet itself turning underneath Miley. You can use Miley to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the Earth is a sphere. It's a ball of rock, and it turns on its own axis. The reason the sun seems to arch through the heavens isn't because there's some god in a fiery chariot dragging it around. It's because the Earth is a ball and it turns. And even better than that, if Miley happened to have a wristwatch on, as you kidnapped her, bundled her into the boot of DeLorean, and took her back to the 1500s, you could use nothing more than that wristwatch to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's the Earth that orbits the sun and not vice versa. You can use Miley to prove the heliocentric universe and imagine all of the trouble and strife that you could save Copernicus and Galileo, the threats of being burned at the stake, if only they had Miley back in the 1500s to prove some of those things for them. So thanks very much, guys, for listening so attentively. You've been a very, very lovely audience. We do have some time now for questions or Q&A and discussion. If you can maybe lift up the light again. And if you haven't finished filling out your post note, do that one now. Thank you. Do we have a roving mic ready to go?
Yep. If you have any questions, we're actually going to have people line up here by this mic stand to make it a little easier. Go ahead. We have plenty of time for discussion, so this should be interesting. And please put the microphone close to your mouth when you're speaking.
Chuck. So you mentioned that we might want to make our way through like this tech tree that we developed as a civilization. I'm wondering, are there certain areas where we might want to bypass the mistakes we've made? Like maybe we've kind of painted ourselves into a corner based on the path we took, and we've got another chance we do it differently?
Yeah, it is a very, very good question. And I lay out the general architecture of knowledge you could use to reboot civilization after an apocalypse in the book. But I try not to make any prescriptions about the way you should do that. If you're building your own society, you get to make up what kind of society you want. You get to make your own decisions about what you might value or what you might try to avoid repeating again and repeating the same mistakes. And in fact, in some respects, you'll probably be forced into doing things differently a second time around, because the world today is not the same as the world 10,000 BC. We've changed things, we've dug things up. And the case of kind of metal, that there's not much good iron ore left in the ground, because we've dug it all up. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. Because if even 10,000 years later, you come across the crumbled ruins of a city, the kind of girders left in skyscrapers, they may have corroded, they may have rusted, but the metal is still in there. And you could smelt the iron back out of a rusty girder in just the same way you would have smelted it out of a lump of ore in the first place. But the crude oil that existed before we started civilizing is no longer there. We've sucked it up and we've burned it, and it now it's above our heads, causing many of its own problems. So in some respects, you might be forced into what I call a green reboot. You might have to make very different decisions in this trajectory and do things in a much more sustainable and kind of closed circuit way. And particularly with energy, you might struggle to provide enough energy for your civilization without all this easy dollops of it lying around from coal and oil today.
Thanks again. And you know, given that the knowledge is probably all in your head and you don't really need the book, what would you have written on the post-it?
So then
what would you have written on the post-it?
I knew someone was gonna ask that. I just thought of an answer. What was the question I asked? What bit of knowledge would you try, or what thing?
Or the knowledge thing, or thing. Yeah.
The thing I would save would be the lathe, which is quite a boring answer. And I hope I'll make it more of an interesting answer if I explain why I'd pick the lathe. Because the lathe is a bit of machinery, it's a machine tool, and you have a kind of a base and a spindle that you can put something on and turn it, and then work on that. So you have a wood turning lathe making chair legs, but also you can have a metal lathe making like pistons and cylinders and useful bits of machinery. And the lathe is very interesting. is once you've got one lathe, you can use a lathe to make all the components you need for other lathes. Like the knowledge, I say tongue-in-cheek, could be produced, it's like seeing how you make new books. The lathe is capable of self-reproduction. And even better than that, even if you don't have one lathe yet, if you're starting from absolute scratch, you can hard make a lathe and use that to complete all the further components you need to finish your lathe, and then use your finished lathe to improve the original components you kind of brought together in the first place and iteratively improve. And there's an exquisite project by a machinist called Dave Gingery, who made a lathe. And once you've got a lathe, you can make a milling machine and then an entire metalworking metal workshop. He started with nothing more than a pile of sand, a pile of clay, and some old coke cans or other soda drink. And to use the aluminium and the clay and a bucket to make a back garden, a backyard furnace, smelt the aluminium, and then cast it into the sand to make the bit, the components of a lathe, she built from scratch, and then used the lathe to make all the other bits of machinery in this workshop, starting with nothing, sand, clay, some old tin cans, which I think is a phenomenal example of this idea of bootstrapping from absolutely nothing, provided you've got the knowledge as to how to do it. Dave Gingery. So if you go to the book's website, theknowledge.org, if you click on prepare, I have some prep hacks there, there'll be a sub-tab to read, and the entire bibliography, the kind of 400 books and references I used in searching for this book, every single one of them is hyperlinked. So it'll either take you to the free PDF or to Amazon where you can buy that book if you want to. So look for the Dave Gingery series of books. It's got a series of 5 books that take you right from the beginnings up to a complete workshop. Sorry.
Earlier, I don't remember who said it, but in the introduction, there was some discussion of Lord of the Flies, which implies that some of what you have to invent and reboot and not lose are social institutions and cooperation, companies, business, law, scholarship, education, and so on, leadership. Do you give any thought to what it would take to get people all on the same page to do some of these things?
It is a very, very good question. Again, I do discuss it briefly. Insofar as the book is the one book you need to rebuild everything, there's quite a lot of stuff you'd want to put in, and only 300 pages. So I made the kind of executive decision, as you like, as a scientist writing a popular science book, to focus on the science and technology. Because I think it's fair to say the laws of science are universal. The technology is universal. The human body needs particular things to be provided for it, as I tried to kind of explain in the talk. So it doesn't matter where you are on the planet or when you are in the future, you'll need the same things. And that's what I've tried to provide in the book. But of course you're right that to have a successful society, a vibrant society that can progress to technological sophistication, there's more than just the knowledge you need. You need a stable society. You need economics and capital generation and people to not be running around with machetes hacking bits and pieces off each other. But I do connect it to that Mad Max, Lord of the Flies, the road type scenario. But of course, we've all seen the film. I don't think there's much more said about that. And the start off point that I begin with, the premise, this thought experiment, the knowledge, is, yeah, sure, it's happened. Of course, you have a Lord of the Flies period. But things have settled down now. You have a kind of peaceable society that's ready to start progressing. Now what you need to know in order to do that. But there is more to it than just the knowledge, of course, yeah. Thanks.
Cool talk. Yeah, I second this comment. And the extension of that is, what are your thoughts on the utility of religion as a means, especially in the rebuilding period, to give people hope and whatnot and not revert into a Mad Max type situation?
Again, I think religion, or at least religiosity, is another very interesting point, which I largely sweep under the carpet and kind of avoid in the knowledge. Maybe it's not to kind of open a can of worms. Because I would be curious, if I got to actually do this experiment and crash civilization and see what happened afterwards, to run maybe a computer game or something, I'd be curious as to whether the surviving community after doomsday, after an apocalypse that wipes out the vast majority of humanity, would they be more religious afterwards or less religious? Would you, by the very fact you've survived, everyone else has died, would you assume by that you're somehow special or chosen